Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday afternoon. You may have seen the cover story in the New York Times a couple weeks ago on the NFL and football players who have suffered from pretty bad head injuries, and how the NFL now, as our guest has said, has been shadowed by bad news this year. He writes in the article, none of it directly related to the issue of head injuries, but everything about football now looks a little different, knowing what we know about the game's impact on players' brains. And it's a very, very lengthy article that looks at a lawyer who took on some of these football players, and through a combination of his brother knowing somebody who was doing autopsies on these brains, he wound up finding many, many football players, and it's become a huge story, as you know. Actually, it's very timely today because tomorrow there's going to be a fairness hearing providing former NFL athletes, their families, and their lawyers with an opportunity to appear before courts to give reasons as to why the proposed NFL concussion settlement, which is something like $765 million, is unreasonable, inadequate, unfair, or arbitrary. We've been seeing so many stories about this that it makes you wonder about the future of football in this country, if we will see these kinds of claims go the way tobacco went, and eventually if we'll see football not being played in the form that it is. Maybe it'll become touch football because of the way that it is played and the impact that it's had on so many athletes who have had dementia, who have been homeless, who may have exhibited some kinds of anger tendencies because of injuries to their brains. It's a fascinating story, and it's told so well by our guest, who is Michael Sokolov. Michael Sokolov is a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, and he wrote this wonderful book a couple years ago, which was one of my favorite books of the whole year, Drama High, the incredible true story of a brilliant teacher, a struggling town, and the magic of theater, which is evidently now going to be made into a movie, which is terrific. Michael writes many, many kinds of articles. Sports and the culture of sports is one of his special areas, but obviously drama high school teachers are also one of his specialties. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I think we'll have many of them as we talk about football, the autopsies that have been performed, the injuries that many NFL players have experienced and how it's affected them. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Michael, hello. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's a pleasure, Kathleen, and thanks for that very kind introduction.
Well, I love that book so much, and now it's being made into a movie. I'm so glad to hear that, Michael.
Well, I hope so. You know, these things are long processes, so it's been bought and is being developed by Sony Pictures Television, so it's possibly going to be a TV thing. Who knows? We writers always hope for the best.
Well, I'll hope for the best for you as well. What a fascinating story you have written here, and you really have to wonder about the future of this game. Tell me about the characters involved, particularly the lawyer and his backstory, which is interesting, and then his older brother who was in medical residency, and his friend, this doctor, who did an autopsy on Mike Webster, the former Pittsburgh Steelers offensive lineman. It's an interesting trio.
Well, you know, my initial interest in the story, because many people have written about the NFL concussions issue, the medical aspects of it particularly, and I was interested in this lawyer, Jason Lukasiewicz, who was a young lawyer, not even yet a partner in Pittsburgh, which, you know, Pittsburgh is almost like Green Bay or Minnesota, or, you know, it's a real football loving city. You know, for the Steelers are sacrosanct there, and no one thought that the NFL could be taken on legally. No one, but Jason Lukasiewicz's brother was friends with a Nigerian pathologist named Bennett Amalu, and Bennett Amalu was the first one who autopsied the brains of some deceased players and found that young brains, 50 years old, 40 years old, sometimes under 40, of these deceased players looked like very old men. They looked like they showed signs of someone who had something like Alzheimer's or dementia or what is sometimes called punch drunk syndrome. Mm. And Bennett Omalu raised his hand and he said, there's something wrong here, and he was pilloried for it. And Jason Lukasiewicz, the lawyer, was his friend. And his initial interest was just to say, hey, let me step up for Bennett, because I don't think he would make something like that up. What's in it for him?
Mm-hmm.
And as Jason got more deeply into it, he became, you know, the lawyer that started this big lawsuit. And so for me, as a writer, the story became one of these, you know, the initial thing for me was not even so much a football story, but, you know, one courageous person who was not cowed by something big like the NFL and just stepped up in righteous anger and decided, I'm going to take this on.
And you write about the fact that to do that, to build a case against the NFL, he had to win the trust of former players. And this is a distinct, as you say, subculture. They have built their lives, their identities, playing a violent game, but they are still deeply invested in football and deeply connected.
Well, absolutely. I mean, football, you know, more so now than baseball, which used to be our national pastime, more so than any sport in America, is very much a part of our culture. So these men grew up not only playing the game, but being so deeply invested in the whole meaning of the game. And it's a game that involves a lot of pain, a lot of toughness. It involves, you know, the camaraderie that comes out of that. And so they were bonded to each other, bonded to the game of football, and to then make the turn, the psychological turn, and say, this game that I loved, this game that to some extent took care of me if they had a long career, you know, damaged me,
mm-hmm.
you know, just left me, in many cases, half a person. It's a tremendous leap for them, and it wasn't something where he said, hey, we have a lawsuit here. Do you think you should sue? It was a much longer process than that.
And he eventually got some other bigger name lawyers involved in this, but it was a fairly brave thing for him to do this. He was the first, right? And if you're the first, you have to be believed, and you're taking on the NFL, for heaven's sake. This is no small thing.
Well, you know, part of this is really a story about the legal system. Those lawyers' ads that say, you know, we don't get paid unless you do, those are plaintiffs' lawyers, and they have a mixed reputation in our society. You see their names on the back of phone books and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But they deeply believe that they are protecting, you know, real people, and that if government doesn't correctly regulate something, the laws are not written correctly, you know, they will stand up and win people justice. And, you know, that you can, you know, different people feel different ways about that. And there's certainly excesses in our tort system, as it's called. But since they don't get paid unless you do, as their ads say, these cases are an investment. And they sometimes a substantial investment on the part of their law firms. And Lukasiewicz's law firm did not want to do it. He was a young lawyer. They did not fully believe in him. So he really had a bond and align with some much bigger law firms around the country. And the end result for this young lawyer is he really got, to a certain extent, edged out of the end of this case. The big settlement, or not as big as some people hope, but the settlement was negotiated by older, more established lawyers. And one of the things that I felt good about in the writing of the story was to sort of bring Jason Lukasiewicz out of the shadows and say, here's the guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are these big dudes who came in at the end and will collect, you know, massive fees. But this is the guy that stepped up when they would not.
Mm-hmm. And you talked to his wife. She was worried about this when it all started. She said she wasn't a risk taker like he was, but wondered, what's this going to do to your career?
Well, she was terrified. She's also a lawyer who had stepped out of her career to raise their young children, to stay at home and raise their young children. And Lukasiewicz was someone who, you know, not too many years before had been driving, you know, a 100-some-mile round trip every day to Johnstown from Pittsburgh, just doing deposition after deposition of people who had been made sick in a steel plant where they had been exposed to asbestos. So he was doing the grunt work of the plaintiff's bar. And I thought it was sort of cool just to bring him forward because, you know, we think of various professions as lucrative. We think of them as maybe glamorous in some ways. But the law, like a lot of other professions, is full of grunts. And this guy that ended up on the cover of the New York Times magazine was a grunt.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people will say, well, listen, it's a rough and tumble game. You go into football, you know what it's going to be. You're taking a certain amount of risks. Did the NFL use that when they were trying, when the suit here was brought? And what did players say about that? Did they know the kinds of risks they were taking?
Well, this case, of course, never got to trial. And the NFL certainly would have tried to use that assumed risk argument. And they would have had other arguments as well, some more technical arguments about whether these players even had the right to sue or whether it should go to arbitration. But that assumed risk argument is very interesting because, you know, these are players, these are retired players who are suing and who make up this class of as many as 20,000 in this
class
action
suit. Wow, really? Oh, my
goodness. Well, those are the ones who are eligible. There are 5,000 named plaintiffs right now. But, you know, many of them are in their 40s and 50s and 60s, and what they all say is, look, we knew we might get, you know, lifelong injuries to our knees, to our hips, to our shoulders, that we might walk in a way that was painful, but we did not know that, you know, at 40 or 50 years old, we would get in our car one day and drive out for a gallon of milk, and by the time I get to the end of my driveway, I can't remember, you know, why I got in the car. You know, that their assumed risk did not involve their intellectual and emotional well-being.
Mm-hmm. There could still be, could there not, the possibility of a civil trial? You write that the players have the choice of opting out of this settlement here and suing the league as individuals.
Some players will go it alone. You know, one prominent family who appears ready to go it alone is the family of the late Junior Seau, who is one of the best linebackers in NFL history and is one of, you know, several players who committed suicide or died violent deaths, and then upon autopsy, their brains showed evidence of CTE. And I'm not going to attempt to pronounce what that stands for, but it is the syndrome of being, you know, brain damaged from football in the way that boxers are often brain damaged from boxing. So Junior Seau's family is going to go it alone. There will be, you know, several dozen others that go it alone. They will have individual trials, and it will take a long time, and the NFL will have the ability to appeal, and it will be drawn out, and they will see if they can do better than this settlement would do for them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're just going to have to see how that goes. The NFL bought itself out of a lot of trouble if this settlement goes through, but they still have to face these individual suits. And, you know, the argument for the individual players is as follows. If I am a 25-year-old guy and I am working, let's say, in some kind of machine shop and something falls on my head from above and causes me devastating brain damage, and that employer knew that that was possible, that something above me was not secured, you know, the possibility of what I could win from a jury is, you know, 10,000, 10
sure.
million, 20 million,
mm-hmm.
$100 million. It's almost limitless. The cap on this for individual players is $5 million, and most of them won't get close to that. So that's the argument against this settlement, and it's a strong argument.
Mm-hmm. And what is the hearing? Get us up to date. What's happening tomorrow?
What's happening tomorrow is federal judge Anita Brody in Philadelphia looked at this settlement initially, which was capped at $765 million. And she looked at it and she said there's not enough money in this for this fund to last the couple of decades it's supposed to last to properly compensate all the players who may need to be compensated. So they went back to the drawing board, and the NFL then was required to come forward with, okay, how many players really are going to be affected here and what will be their claims? And this is where this devastating statistic came out, that 28% of former NFL players will at some point in their lifetime and be diagnosed with dementia, and many of them at young ages, so early onset dementia. So this is where that came out of. So what Judge Brody is going to do in this hearing is look at the new shape of the settlement, which uncaps the total amount that the NFL might pay, but does not increase the cap on individual players at $5 million. And she's expected to approve that settlement, perhaps with some modifications.
You also, in the article, talk about what's happening on other levels. When you look at below the professional level, there are some changes. California passing a law barring state middle school and high schools from conducting full contact practices for more than 3 hours a week during the season. Contact not allowed at all during the off season. Do you see this beginning to happen in many schools? Because we've also seen problems and deaths with high school football players, three in about a week's period of time a few months ago. I would imagine this is all under real, real scrutiny at the high school level, too, isn't it? And the college level.
Well, I think this is the bigger question. You know, the NFL remains a great entertainment product. But the questions are, who's going to play? When I walk down my block with the local high schools about a block away, and I see these boys on the field, and I do wonder what parent, what mother, what father is allowing their boy to play football. And fewer and fewer are. The numbers are going down. And so you have a question of who's going to play? Is football going to become less of a national game and more of a game that the players come from certain parts of the country and from certain lower socioeconomic classes, perhaps. And then the other question is, you know, how are we as consumers going to regard football? The more we know about its impacts, is it going to just become too distasteful to watch players whom we know are doing lifelong damage to their consciousnesses? Now, that's not happening yet, and I will acknowledge that after this story came out, you know, people wrote me and said, I'm not watching football either. And I had to say, well, I do still watch football. And I can't necessarily defend it, but it's a game that I played and that I have watched all my life. And so I'm not going to say that the tide has turned, but I do think, and this is what the story raised, I do think that the future of football as we know it is very much in doubt. You know, not next year, not the year after, but a decade or two or three down the line, as more scientific evidence and medical evidence is revealed, you really have to question whether this sport is going to remain the central part of our culture that now is.
Fascinating. You may still watch football, but Luka Cevic, who used to go to games as a child, doesn't watch football anymore, does he?
No, he does not. And, you know, because this is his work day after day after day. And he, you know, said that in his hometown of Pittsburgh, Sundays was for football and church. I guess church and football would be the proper order. And, you know, as is the case in many, many communities and households across the country, but he can't watch it anymore. And I understand that. I really do.
Well, let's welcome calls from our audience. Do you think, considering all that we've heard here, that football in its current form just can't exist because we will find it too distasteful? That's an amazing statistic, that 28% of former NFL players will be diagnosed with dementia, early stage dementia. 28%. What do we do with that fact? Does this settlement strike you as way too low? Do you think that what we're hearing about the health effects, the brain damage that takes place, means that we have to make it not our national sport in its current form? Is there a way to play football where you don't get brain injury? Would you, if you have a child or if you have somebody in your life who could have played football, would you have let them play football? What about now? Would you let your child play football now? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. I know the Green Bay Packers are close to being a religion in the state of Wisconsin, so I'm sure we'll have a lot of football fans who will have thoughts about this, and it's a question that needs serious consideration. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Jack Forbes Wilson will be with us. Jack played Liberace at the Stackner Cabaret 4 years ago here in Milwaukee, and it was so successful. It's just an extraordinary performance that it's been revived, and it will be at the Stackner Cabaret until January 11th, at which point Jack will take the show to Philadelphia. So we'll talk about the life of Liberace and the life of a pianist and actor coming up. Hour two of our program. Well, our phone lines are jammed for Michael. And if you want to see Michael's piece, it's on our Facebook page, too. It's a very lengthy. Michael's a heck of a writer. So go to our Facebook page or to the New York Times. It was the Sunday magazine a week ago. Elizabeth in Fish Creek, our first caller for you, Michael. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thrilled that you're having this show. I had the conversation the other day in a room full of people who acted as though I was a complete freak that I didn't let my kid play high school football. I had a cousin who was crippled in high school football many, many years ago, and I think it's dangerous. I am shocked that it continues to be a sport that we watch. It seems like gladiator games. And for me, there are points as a parent when you find that if you're going to apply some basic critical thinking skills, you're going to be at odds with the culture. So, you know, I didn't assume that the day my kids turned 16, that meant that they automatically drove. They had to be responsible. I had to think that I'm going to put you on a road with other people. I don't want to be responsible for your mistakes on the road. So I don't assume that every 16-year-old has a right to drive because they had a birthday. And I certainly don't think, when you look at all this evidence, that we should be having kids in high school play football. I think it's nuts that it still happens. So thank you for your show.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. Michael.
Well, I think that that's a reasonable way to feel. I think that you know, there are some difficult questions, legal questions, and there are some difficult questions about what a professional football player may know about risk right now if he's entering the game. But in terms of a parent making a decision on whether a child should play football, a parent who says that's just too dangerous and I can risk all kinds of things for my child, but not, you know, repeated head blows that might change their future, it's a perfectly reasonable way to feel, no doubt.
Eric in Madison, hi.
Hi, yeah, this is just a great topic because I've been a lifelong fan of football. Yeah, I grew up in Wisconsin, you know, watched Packers all my life, and you know, especially coming off of this weekend of, you know, great football victories for both the UW
right.
Badgers and the Packers. But I'm still so torn because of this issue where I watch these games, but I feel so guilty about it, and I've got a three-year-old son who's just a really athletic little boy, and I know that when it comes to when he gets old enough that we're not going to let him play football because of these issues, and so I'm just struggling with this guilt of watching football, and all of my college buddies, we've had this email trail going on for the last few month and a half or so about watching football, where a lot of my college friends are no longer watching football.
Really?
Yeah, I'm just really torn, and this is a really, really important subject to talk about. So it's a great time for this show. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Eric. Now you can feel even more torn, Michael.
Well, I think the question that Eric raises is a really good one, because the question of whether you let your child play is a parental decision. It's a practical decision. The stakes are very easily known. I think that the question of whether we watch is really a philosophical one, and I don't have the answer to it. If you watch, are you complicit? You know, I really don't know. I think the answer is certainly a partial yes. If we don't watch, it doesn't exist. I think we're decades and decades away from that. But, you know, maybe it's a cop-out, but I think, you know, in terms of watching, you know, I think that all of us who do watch at least have the option of saying, well, let's see how this develops.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't say for sure that's defensible. But I do think it's an interesting question about our own complicity as consumers of this game.
Do you think, and I'm wondering if this will find its way to the courts in some way, Michael, that there is some kind of relationship between the brain injury and some of the much publicized and horrendous acts of child abuse and domestic violence we've seen on the part of football players?
Well, the short answer is yes. I think there has to be. If we are to believe the science, and there's no reason not to believe the science, I think yes. I think it's very difficult to prove that cause and effect, but I think we will increasingly see it come up in the sort of venue of criminal trials or league discipline hearings. Because, look, the repeated head blows, the concussions, what the science says is it has an impact on judgment and impulse control, and that can happen at very young ages. And when you see crimes that have to do with judgment and impact control, you have to at least ask the question about that connection. And I'll add one more thing. When you look at the case, for example, of Adrian Peterson,
mm-hmm.
who is the Minnesota running back who was accused of beating his child, his very young child, with a switch,
yeah.
Which is a very polite term for a tree branch stripped of its leaves. Now, Adrian Peterson had a pretty tough life, apparently, growing up. A lot of these guys, not all of them, and I don't want to generalize, but some guys come into the NFL with, you know, their own deficits. You know, and that's true of people in all kinds of businesses. But if you have some social deficits, and then you add on that you've been knocked around in the head a lot, and you combine these two things, it's a recipe for some poor behavior. And I don't want to come off the wrong way. I think the NFL is made up of guys of different classes, of different races. I think that there are white players and there are black players who come from the same kind of deficit. So I'm not making that kind of general statement. But I'm saying that if you come into this setting and you're not sort of all together to begin with. And there are some guys in the NFL who are like that, and then you play a violent game, you have to question in a legal setting, you know, what does that look like in the end?
Mm. Let's go to Robert in Glendale. Hello, Robert.
Hi. I've got a couple of questions. One is general and one is more specific. The general one is there anything that can practically be done to make the game less damaging in terms of head injuries?
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, it seems to me that the level of head protection that the league has developed in some ways actually enables players to take more risks because they think they're protected. And what would the game look like if they actually had to play with less or no head protection?
Hmm.
Would it actually be more or less risky in terms of head injuries and cognitive deficits resulting from those?
Thank you very much, Robert. Good questions.
Those are both great questions. To take on the first one, what would make the game safer? The NFL is in the midst of a very well-funded, really public relations campaign at this point. I believe it's called Heads Up Tackling. And it's all about how younger players can tackle without leading with their head. It's very, very questionable, the real effect of that. I talked to a couple of former NFL players, one of them, Nate Jackson, who's a very thoughtful former player, who wrote a book called Slow Getting Up. I was not going to be able to come up with that title, and thankfully it's sitting right on my desk. Slow Getting Up. But Nate said to me, look, you know, ergonomically, you know, a force is coming at you, and this force is very big and very strong and maybe bigger than you. Mm. If you have your head up, as you put it, you're going to be embarrassed. So the competitive instinct is you lower your head, and the ball carrier lowers his head, and you collide sometimes. Mm. And also, so much of the head impact that goes on a football field is not even near the ball. It's blocking. It's subconcussive hits. So there's no evidence that anything that's being tried so far will work. There's only hope. Research may prove that it is helpful. Research may prove that it's not. But the game cannot be said to be being made safer right now because there's no research to back it. The second question about no helmets, I'm given to believe that. I think if players played without helmets, it would be safer because you would get your head out of the way.
Hmm.
There's no doubt that's something that makes some sense. But I think aesthetically, it's a non-starter in American football. You know, part of the appeal of the game is the way the game looks. And I don't see that happening. I just don't. The helmet is part of the gladiator gear and the gladiator aesthetic.
What do you mean? I wanted you to talk about this in a little more detail before we go back to calls. You write in your article, what if the template for football's future is not the fate of boxing, but rather that of the tobacco industry?
Well, the tobacco industry had great centrality in our culture. You know, a majority of Americans at one point smoked. You could smoke, you know, on a bus in a college classroom and a car with your kids in it. You know, it was just everywhere. And the tobacco industry was so big and powerful, it was impossible to imagine it being anything less than big and powerful. And I think that football is that way now. You know, the smaller that other forms of entertainment become, the more diffuse our entertainment universe is, with us watching fewer and fewer things in real time. The Super Bowl and the 16 regular season games and the playoffs, you know, are watched by immense audiences,
no.
You know, way bigger than anything else. So we can't imagine that football could come down from its perch. But I think the same factors that made the tobacco industry and tobacco's centrality that changed that, which is we just realized this is really bad for you. It's really bad for you. We can't have it. I mean, I think that football is possibly, if not probably, on that path.
Mm. Let's go to Jonathan in Madison. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, how you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
I just want to speak from a former athlete's perspective, as well as a professional athlete. As far as the danger in the game, that's kind of like everybody who plays football, they know the danger when they start to play. And just from speaking from a former high school football perspective, the game is dangerous if it's played the wrong way. But if it's played properly and safely, I think kids can gain a lot of social skills and interpersonal skills that you can learn from being on a football team, playing a team sport. And I think if you get away from that, you'll take a lot of kids who really wouldn't get the type of exposure to a different group of people and things like that. If you just stop the game completely in high school, I think you would lose a lot of people from being able to have those type of experiences.
Mm. What about the young players? We've had all these alarming situations, though, Jonathan, of young players dying during games just in the last month and a half. I mean, that's disturbing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very disturbing. And for me, just being in – ever playing the game for as long as I have, there has been deaths and there has been people who have been hurt pretty severely as far as neck injuries and head injuries, but still at the same time, if kids are taught properly the same thing, that's why I think the heads up football is a good thing, and that's why I think playing without a helmet is kind of ridiculous to kind of think about it. But the kids dying on the field, like it's probably over a million kids that play this game every day, you know, and
right.
Walking across the street is a dangerous deal also. But I just think with the public perception of how dangerous the game is and how it's in light as far as these few individuals who have put a black eye on the game as far as what they're doing in their personal lives, as far as disciplining their children and them interacting with their spouses, you know, like it just didn't start overnight when people, when you talk about domestic abuse. And I think that's a totally different issue. And I hate to see it coupled with football, even though the head injuries are a direct influence of some of these people's actions, but this has been going on for a long time, and I think it's a shame for it to happen to a football player for now, all of a sudden in the public's eye,
yeah,
when it's happened for a long time and nobody has stood up to say anything.
Jonathan, did you play professional football?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Well, what do you make of this figure that Michael gave in the article in the New York Times that 28% of former NFL players will be diagnosed with dementia? What do we do about that?
I'm glad those numbers are coming out because I do have friends made and of course their lives they may develop that facilitates disease and it is something that needs to be addressed and I think with the rule changes and the things they're doing to try to make it more safe for the players, I think it's a good thing and I think it's a good advancement for the game. You know, just not too long ago, football was played without a face mask and that's kind of unthinkable in today's game and age where the players are bigger, stronger, faster than they were 30, 40 years ago.
Right.
So, as I think, you know, as humans evolve and develop and people get bigger and stronger, you do need to put these guidelines in the game to help these people be safe because when you're 24, 25, you're really not thinking about by the time you're 40, you know?
Yeah.
And mortality really isn't a thing that young men who are in these age groups kind of think about. And it's not until you get older to your mid-30s and late 40s where you start thinking about what you want to do to the second half of your life.
Yeah. Michael, you may have some questions for Jonathan, former professional football player.
Well, I think he's made some really, you know, he's made very good points and points, you know, that I take. I think that what's to be gained from playing football by young men, and it is mostly men, you know, very rarely girls, you know, is important. You know, it's really important. I would question whether you couldn't get the same benefits out of playing other sports.
Baseball
right. and soccer and basketball, some of which have their own danger. So it's a question of how much danger you're going to accept. The one issue that I would question that Jonathan said is that the game has been made safer. I do not believe that research backs that the game has been made safer. I would say the game may have been made safer. There were fewer violent hits on the field. There's no doubt Jonathan and I and anybody who follows football can see there are fewer violent hits. But unfortunately, what the research shows is that the brain injuries often accrue, you know, on a succession of much less violent hits that sometimes we don't even see on camera. It's just, you know, guys on the line butting heads for, you know, 70 plays a game or whatever it is. So, but I guess I would ask Jonathan, you know, your colleagues, your former players, your friends, there must be a lot of different opinions on all this, I would assume.
Is there, Jonathan, your former colleagues? I'm sorry, he's gone. Jonathan, if you want to get in touch with us, too, we'd love to hear from you. It'd be great to have a former professional player on to talk about some of this. He made an interesting point, and I wonder how this factors in, that the players are bigger, faster, stronger. They're bigger people, aren't they? So if you take a blow, it's going to hurt more.
Well, they're certainly bigger, and they're certainly faster, and those two things. I didn't get very far in physics, but I didn't get anywhere. But, you know, we all know the implications of that. And the helmets are not protective at all. And Jonathan mentioned the face masks. I don't know that they're protective. Anything, including the face masks, that make a player think that he can put his head in there is probably a danger. I mean, I watched a game yesterday, and they showed the replay, and a player aimed his head at the football in order to cause a fumble, which is a very common tactic. That's still allowed. So the head is still being used as a weapon and as a tactic, and that specifically is what is causing, you know, the results that pathologists are seeing in their autopsies.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the future of football this hour of the program and whether or not it's going the way of tobacco in this country. Our guest has written a very provocative, very lengthy and thorough story in the New York Times Magazine. It's the front page story from a week ago this Sunday. Michael Sokolov is our guest, and he is a contributing writer for the New York Times. Michael wrote a book that we interviewed him about a couple of years ago, Drama High, the incredible true story of a brilliant teacher, a struggling town, and the magic of theater. I highly recommend if you haven't read this book. It was one of my favorite books of that year. It's going to be made into a movie as well. He's written about all kinds of topics, writing for the Times. Also, he wrote for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he's written about life in inner city America, eco-terrorism, presidential politics, to the question of whether would-be assassin John Hinckley should go free. His specialty is the sociology and culture of sports. More phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is our number. Facebook, put your thoughts on Facebook, too, because we can all go there after the show and read what we all think about this. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. We'd love to read your comments, and we have some emails we'll get to in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jack in Milwaukee, the next caller. Hi, Jack.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to start off and say I'm 25, and when and if I have a son, I'm not going to allow him to play football, though I do still watch football on Sundays. But my main point would be that, with the exception of perhaps older players and the possibility that the NFL and the commissioner hid the science behind a brain injury caused by playing football, I think that the blame is sort of misplaced within the settlement that the players have reached with the NFL. Players know full well the possibilities of injury and brain injury, that at least the players that are playing today, and I believe they get paid well enough to be able to say, you know, this is a risk I'm willing to take, to be paid millions of dollars a year, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, players today do know the risks, right, Michael?
Yes, I mean, the point Jack makes is a point that I'll agree with to a certain degree. First of all, the guys in this settlement, he said, you know, the settlement puts the blame in the wrong place. But the guys in the settlement are largely in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. So they did not know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe if they were reading medical journals, they could have figured it out, but they did not know. In terms of these players now, they do know. And, yes, you can say they are assuming the risk. I will add, when Jack says they're very well paid, I would argue with that. Football is the least remunerative of our sports. A lot of players have very short careers. The average is, you know, the average is 3 years.
Really?
So most guys come out of NFL football, you know, without a great deal of money. They may make, you know, $400,000 or $500,000 a year for 3 years. You know, that does not set you up for life. It's certainly a lot of money while you're making it, but I wouldn't say that it's worth the damage that you might get out of it.
Mm-hmm. Let's read a couple emails and then respond to what you will. Chris from Wisconsin Dells pointed out our mixed up priorities. The two highest paid state employees are Barry Alvarez and Gary Anderson, the current athletic director and football coach for the Wisconsin Badgers. Ron says on email, I love football. There are calculated risks in anything. If you don't like it, don't watch. And he goes on to say he wishes he could have realized his own dream of playing. He asks how many people fall into depression in their cubicles each year with no rights and no money.
So it's cubicle life versus the NFL.
Right.
Those are not. I guess that's one way of looking at it. I'm not sure how to respond.
In terms of money, you mentioned Roger Goodell's salary in your piece. I mean, holy cow, there is so much money involved in this sport.
Yeah, I can't remember. You know, I'm not looking at the piece. What was it?
$44 million.
$44 million
right.
A year. You know, I think that's $44 million a year for, like, shooting layups. I mean, he's the commissioner of a league that can't lose, that is just a money-minting machine. So I would do that job for so much less money, and I think the NFL would be fine. But, look, it's a private industry, and that's what they decide to pay him, although I will add that the players are incensed by that particular salary. And when you weigh it against, you know, the maximum that a player can get for the most horrific damage suffered playing football is $5 million. And you weigh that's not a year.
Right.
That's just $5 million. You weigh that against the guy at the top of the heap here who makes $44 million in a single year.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if that's in the category life's not fair, but it incenses some of the guys.
Understandably. Patricia in Madison, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My personal feeling is that Roger Goodell should be forced to resign, not only for his recent ignorance of the impact of domestic violence and the minor penalties that were meted out initially, but public television has produced a wonderful program on Frontline that has been shown several times where Goodell testified before Congress and denied these brain changes were occurring because of the repeated head injuries and said their own doctors were looking into it. And interesting, you should bring up the tobacco industry because in that presentation before Congress, one of the people questioning him had said, you know, compared him to those from the tobacco industry who denied for all those years that there was any danger of the product. And I think at this point, I heard not too long ago that over 95 or so brains have been autopsied, and of those, 90 or more have shown these marked changes of CTE. And I think that's chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
Very good. You got the pronunciation
down.
That was
impressive.
Yes, it was. Michael, your response.
Well, first of all, the PBS show she referenced grows out of the book League of Denial, which is by Mark Finero Wada and his brother Steve Finero, and these two guys are the giants of this story. They're the pace setters on the story, and they are the investigative reporters along with a man named Alan Schwartz. Who was writing for the New York Times on this subject, and you know they got way out in front on this, and they really opened up a lot of things that Roger Goodell would not have wanted to see the light of day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a magazine writer and not an investigative reporter, although I certainly do some investigative reporting, but you know my thing is more in making the cultural connections. These guys, the Finero brothers and Alan Schwartz, really deserve a lot of credit, and I'm glad that she mentioned them. In addition to reeling off the correct pronunciation of CTE, so that took the pressure off of all of them.
Absolutely. One more call. We have about a minute left. Bill in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Well, I got to admit, I played in high school. My father played in high school. I'm in my 70s. We knew it was dangerous even then, but not like this. And our equipment was such that we couldn't do a lot with our heads. But what scares me now, more than the college players, high school players, pros, I'm now watching kids in third and fourth grade playing in full pads,
mm-hmm.
playing full contact. Now, if the human brain isn't fully formed until around 25, and I love football, there is something inside me that I would still play it again, knowing everything I know, which sounds stupid, but what are we doing to these young heads? I mean, that scares
mm-hmm.
me to death.
Well, and you mentioned that in the article. There aren't as many of those young kids playing, but they're still playing, aren't they, Michael?
Well, they're still playing, and, you know, a lot of what's said here scientifically is just said casually, and it's not known, and the caller makes a great point about this. So lots of people said, well, those little boys playing football, they're not that big and they're not hitting each other that hard, and they just sort of crumple to the ground when they hit each other, you know, like boys in a sandbox or something, and that all makes sense. But the very good point that he just raised is, number one, they've got very young brains, and their skulls, which are protective, are not as thick.
Right.
Their necks are not as muscled, which really protect against impact also. So, you know, we casually say, oh, this is okay and that's not okay. The point is, we really, you know, just don't know.
Hmm.
And as long as we don't know, the likelihood is we're going to find out more, and then we're going to have to figure out what to do with it.
Yeah. Michael, thank you so much. I was just delighted to see your name, and it's a heck of a story, just really well done. Thank you for doing it, and it took some bravery on your part to do it as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen. I always enjoyed being on with you.
Michael Sokolov, our guest. It's the Sunday magazine of the New York Times, a week, not this past Sunday, but the week before. He also, if you haven't read Drama High, the incredible true story of a brilliant teacher, a struggling town, and the magic of theater, one of my favorite books from 2 years ago, so inspirational. And it's going to be made into a movie. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the show and for on-air production in downtown Milwaukee. We talk about Liberace next.